I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, a challenge for your holiday feast. What malty drink could you pair with a festive, elegant holiday meal? Here's a hint. It's flavored with hops. If we say beer, do you say no way? We have an expert for you who may challenge your preconceptions about beer. We'll have that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, we want to turn to a mainstay for many people for holiday drinks, wine. And when selecting the right vintage for the season of merriment, choices will range from country to celebrity vintner. Our guest fits both bills. She is award-winning journalist Charlene Hunter-Galt. Yes, our Charlene Hunter-Galt, who now resides in South Africa with her husband, Ron. And this husband and wife team created just what you may need to cap a great meal and lavish entertainment. The label is Passages, and Charlene Hunter-Galt joins us now from Johannesburg. Charlene, welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. It's really a delight to be back with you, especially during this holiday season. You sound so joyful.
Well, thank you. Better now that I'm talking to you. And of course, normally when we talk to you, we talk about the politics and the policy of South Africa and all the events going on the African continent that you cover for us so well. So I think it might be surprising to many people to hear that you, an award-winning veteran journalist, and your husband, Ron, a very successful businessman, have decided to go into the wine business. So what made you decide to do that?
Well, you know, South Africa is known for many things, especially, and Americans know that, you know, the end of apartheid and the entry of the new multiracial government. But one of the things that the end of apartheid has opened up for South Africans is to get its amazing wines into the rest of the world. And so when we came here, my husband came a year before I did. Of course, I came in 97 for NPR. We began to enjoy the wines that are produced here in South Africa. So many of our friends consider themselves connoisseurs, and some are. And so we were exposed to some of the best wines that South Africa has to offer. And at a certain point, we decided that we had had enough of the good stuff that we could embark on it ourselves, but principally for the American market. Because at that point, when we first decided back in 2006, South African wines had not entered the American market in any large degree.
What's the story behind the name of your label, Passages?
We have traveled the world, gone to so many different places, gone through so many different passages through our own lives. We've been married. We just celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary. And so when we thought about what we would call our wine, we thought about the passages that we have gone through life that brought us to South Africa, which has enhanced our taste for all things good, not just the wine and the food, but also the people. And so we wanted something that was really symbolic and unique to our lives, and it turns out it was the passages that we have been through, hence Passages.
And to this point, I understand that you are offering a Chardonnay, a Merlot, and a Cabernet. Do I have that right?
That's right. We have a Chardonnay, and in South Africa, there's someone called a Fundi, who is a knowledgeable person. And so I'm considered the Chardonnay Fundi because I have an appreciation for the American palate. And so I get to taste the Chardonnay, and it's a lovely, has a butterscotch and vanilla flavor, and the aftertaste is lovely. It just sort of floats on the palate and down the throat. We also make a Merlot, which has dark fruit flavors and is just a very smooth red wine. And then we have a Cab Merlot blend where you can taste sweet black currant fruit. And also, it's red. All of these wines are drinkable. You know, some wines you buy, you have to put them in your cellar and keep them for years. Well, ours are immediately available and immediately delicious.
Well, that's good to hear. You know, I'm dying to know this. What's similar and different between being a vintner and being a journalist? What's different and what's the same?
Well, I think it's the excitement of your creative product. I mean, wine is creative in the same way that journalism is. I mean, you know, I think what makes a successful journalist is a person who has the capacity to get excited about just about anything. And I think in that regard, I've gotten very excited about the wine business. And I think the passion that I feel for my work as a journalist, a lot for NPR, my passion for this wine comes through in the tasting, which is why I think the public will like it. I mean, we're just beginning to be all over America. We're right there in Washington, D.C., where we had a tasting recently, sold out of the Chardonnay, sold out of the Merlot. So people reacted to our passion, but the passion that we have is actually in the bottle.
Okay. Award-winning journalist Charlene Hunter Gault is co-owner with her husband Ron Gault of the South African wine label Passages, and she was kind enough to join us from the BBC studios in Johannesburg. Charlene, thank you so much for joining us, and happy holidays to you.
Thank you too, Michelle, and enjoy Passages as you pass through these wonderful holidays.
And let's turn now to the latest volley in the ongoing tariff war. American politicians have vowed to fight new Chinese tariffs on U.S.-made cars and SUVs. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton has more.
In 2010, the U.S. won a Chinese tire dumping complaint before the World Trade Organization. Then China complained about U.S. poultry dumping. The U.S. said China subsidizes solar panels. Now the fight's over cars. Republican Congressman Kevin Brady of Texas heads a trade subcommittee.
They are, in effect, creating cases out of thin air to try to retaliate against our industries. Unfortunately, in this case, it's one of our key industries, American auto.
The new tariffs of up to 20% won't devastate American car companies. Ford and GM build almost all their cars for the Chinese market in China, and Chrysler exports only a few thousand cars to China. Alan Deardorff is with the Ford School of Public Policy. He takes the long view of the tariff disputes.
These things working their way through the system, I think, is much better than working outside the system, which is what used to happen before we had the WTO.
Deardorff says what American politicians are really upset about is China's currency manipulation. That does hurt U.S. companies. The WTO doesn't regulate currency disputes, but it may in the future. Deardorff says that could make these tariff fights with China less frequent. For NPR News, I'm Tracy Samilton in Ann Arbor.
These days, trends in employment are heading in two opposing directions. The private sector is slowly adding jobs, while the public sector continues to shed them. According to the federal government's most recent labor report, payrolls at private employers grew by 140,000 last month. At the same time, government agencies cut 20,000 jobs. Sarah Hewlett of Michigan Radio visited the community of Inkster, Michigan, to find out more about the impact of public sector job loss.
Tammy Warren has lived on the same winding street in this suburb of Detroit all her life. She grew up in the house next door, and she and her family members own four tidy bungalows right in a row. But as she drives me down the block in her Ford pickup, Warren points out the casualties of the housing market collapse.
These two right down here on the right-hand side, these are vacant. These other two that are right here are rental houses. We've got another one that's vacant here. This one's been vacant for a while.
And vacant houses mean less tax revenue for the city.
City of Inkster has eliminated 38 positions. It's about 25% roughly of the workforce.
That's the city treasurer, Mark Stulderer. When I walked into City Hall to interview him, there was no one behind the information desk, and the city clerk's office was empty. The only sign of life in the lobby was the man sitting behind the cashier sign, taking payment for tax and water bills. Stulderer says about 70% of the city budget is spent on people, salaries, and benefits.
You can't automate a police department like you can an auto factory.
So this month, Inkster laid off 14 police officers. That's about 20% of the department. At a diner called Francesco's, residents like Daryl Osborne say they're troubled by the news.
The Inkster police is like our family. Like, we come to the restaurant, they make you feel safe to eat.
Osborne points to the restaurant's new security cameras, which the owner put in when news of the layoffs hit. The diner is a favorite spot for Inkster police, But with fewer officers on the force, there are fewer of them coming in for the $2.25 breakfast special. And Osborne says the restaurant isn't the only place where their absence is felt.
When I ride through the neighborhoods of Inkster, you know, used to see them out, you know, in their cars, you know, patrolling the areas and everything. And you don't see that no more due to the layoffs.
And Inkster is actually faring better than some Michigan cities. Pontiac has dismantled its entire police department, contracting the work out to the county sheriff. And the city is about to get rid of its fire department as well. Betty Buss is a municipal finance expert with the Citizens Research Council of Michigan. She says higher pension and health insurance costs have also added to the challenge.
And unless property taxes increase, which means that the value of properties increase dramatically, the situation's not going to change.
Buss says in the meantime, cities will look to revamp pension plans and collective bargaining agreements. Sharing services and even merging communities are also options for local governments looking to stay in the black. But in the end, there appear to be few good alternatives to laying off public workers. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Hewlett.
Things Considered continues in a moment.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, illegal immigration still sparks fierce political debates, but recent reports suggest that illegal border crossings from Mexico to the U.S. have slowed down dramatically. We'll talk about why that might be in just a few minutes. But first, we want to take a closer look at the changing face of homelessness in America. A new report from the National Center on Family Homelessness shows that the rate of homelessness among children in the U.S. has increased nearly 33% since 2007. This means roughly 1.6 million kids. The data was released as part of a report called America's Youngest Outcasts 2010. We wanted to find out more about this, so we've called upon Dr. Ellen Basuk. She is the founder and president of the National Center on Family Homelessness. Also with us is Mike Pomey. He is the executive director of the Children's Cabinet. That is a nonprofit that provides services for homeless and other at-risk children in Northern Nevada. America's Youngest Outcasts report ranked that state close to the bottom in the U.S. in providing adequate resources for homeless children. Thank you both so much for speaking with us today.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Basuk, and I do want to say you are a medical doctor. Your report is titled America's Youngest Outcasts. It's a very provocative title. I want to ask you why you chose it in a minute. But just to set the table first, when you say homeless, it may seem like a simple question, but I do think it's important to establish this. What exactly do you mean?
It's actually not a simple question. The definition of homelessness has been debated. The HUD definition refers to literal homelessness. In this report, we use the Department of Education definition, which is also used by various other programs, such as the Runaway and Homeless Youth programs. The new HEARTH Act, which has reauthorized McKinney-Vento, uses a broader definition.
We don't know what McKinney-Vento is, so if you just tell us exactly what you mean. What is the definition?
Okay, McKinney-Vento is the legislation that funds most homelessness assistance programs.
Okay. What is the definition of homelessness? What exactly do you mean? Do you mean kids
who... It refers to kids who are literally homeless, as well as kids who are doubled up and precariously housed by reason of economic hardship.
And why do you call these kids outcasts?
They, because of their homelessness status, they have no routines, they have no bed to call their own each night, they're lost for the time being, they're not in the system in any regular way, they sometimes don't attend school, and they reflect, I think, some of society's views of homeless people.
And Mike Pomey, we haven't forgotten about you, but Dr. Basuk, just to tie a bow on this, what are the major factors that you found driving up the number of homeless children? One has to assume that the recession is a part of it, is a big part of it.
Yeah, during times of economic recession or depression, there's always an increase in homeless people. But the numbers of homeless families have increased steadily since the mid-80s. In the mid-80s, only 1% of the overall homeless population were families. Now it's about a third. But the recession has caused a spike in the number of homeless families, and that's what we're seeing right now.
Mike Pomey, the data on foreclosures released just today from the group Realty Trek show that Nevada had the highest foreclosure rate of any state. Is that a factor in what you're seeing in your state?
That's correct. It's a huge factor. What's happened is our families that worked in the construction trade, for example, dad had a well-paying job and mom was working, both lose their employment. Their children are displaced and they're put on the streets basically without employment. So as we grew at the fastest rate in the country, we have declined at the fastest rate in the country, and our foreclosures have led to homelessness where we see it on the streets, where they end up in the community assistance center or shelters or on the streets. A lot of times there's so much stress in the home. Our law enforcement saw an increase in domestic violence where people are unemployed and they're fighting with each other. And then eventually the outcome is the kids are removed either through the child welfare system or they're basically, in some cases, abandoned where mom and dad just up and leave.
And we're talking again about this whole question of who exactly we're talking about here. Do the kids you serve, and when you talk about homelessness, are you talking about the same thing that Dr. Bosick is talking about, which is not necessarily kids who have no shelter at all, but whose circumstances are so precarious, you know, that they don't consider the home their home, or that they're so doubled up to the point where they really don't feel that it just isn't a place that really is a home. Is that what you are talking about as well?
That is what her definition is accurate, although doubled up would seem like a luxury in my opinion. I've seen situations where 10 or more kids are in a single motel room without any other means, no kitchen or whatnot. So two people in a room would be what kind of ideal would be to keep them off the streets. So we have seen it, and our definition is accurate. A lot of our kids are displaced. They couch surf, as what we call it, moving from home to home without a permanent place to call their own. That happens quite often. And they're really a secretive and hidden population, difficult to count, at least in Nevada, because of the couch surfing, the ability to move from place to place. Parents don't ask what they're doing for a couple of weeks, then they try to check in on them, and then they find another location. So our street population doesn't look like some of the other larger cities, but our hidden population is much larger and much more difficult for us to access.
You know, Dr. Bosick was saying that this is a long-term problem that's actually dates back longer than many people might believe that it does. So, Mike, are you seeing a change in the types of families who are kids whom you – or the families whom you are serving or the kids who you're trying to serve, their family circumstances? Have you seen a change over the time?
Well, just as we described, the housing and the recession, as the doctor noted, have been the key drivers for increasing our homeless population in Nevada for sure. And I've seen a difference in the – tone of which kids come before us. Like you said, the parents were working, they had employment, the economy was rolling along, and then all of a sudden you take away that ability to make your payments, and we know the result is they're a lot of times no family, friend, or neighbor to go to, and they end up on the streets. So these people, we've seen an increase all the way through for our shelters, for food, clothing, basic needs. Here's an example. We do an adopt-a-family each year for Christmas for the nonprofit that I'm in at the Children's Cabinet. And we've increased each year the amount of youth and families we serve. And the things they ask for are not what a typical child would ask for toys. They ask for underwear, socks, T-shirts, pants. The most extravagant thing for the child and family I adopted with my wife was a bike helmet. And so we're not seeing Nintendos and Xbox. We're seeing basic survival. Mom and dad asked for pots and pans. So we're back to the old Maslow's hierarchy of needs, of basic needs. We're trying to meet those needs.
And I also heard you say that, you know, there's no family or friends in the area or family particular or extended family to call upon. Is that in part because many of the people who moved to Nevada during the boom times were the first in their whole clan or family to get there, so there really isn't the same network? Is that kind of what you're telling me there?
Right. We're really a transient population based on the casino industry to begin with. And then with the construction trade, it's a boom or bust town with mining and everything else that we do here. So we see peaks and valleys, and you're correct that they show up and they're just on their own as their family system. They're not in a large network of, you know, sustainable family members staying around them, and they find themselves unable to get around. They lose their vehicles. They lose their ability for transportation. It's a wicked web of information that they have kind of thrust upon them to get things moving.
We've been talking about the rise in homelessness among American children, according to a new report. We're talking with Mike Pomey of the Children's Cabinet, a children's service provider in Nevada. That's who was talking just now. Also with us, Dr. Ellen Basak, the president of the National Center on Family Homelessness, which released this report. Dr. Basak, you're a psychiatrist, and I just would like to ask you, a couple minutes that we have left, is what are some of the things that you think people should know about the effect on a child and a family of being homeless that people might not understand or think about at first? Obviously, you know, the sense of insecurity. I mean, anybody who's got a kid, you know, understands that kids crave stability. But what are some other things that you think we should know?
Well, I think one thing that we should know is more than 40% of these kids are less than 6 years old. So there are a lot of youngsters whose actual development may be affected by being homeless. In addition, the school-age kids have a tremendous amount of difficulty learning in school. If you think about what Mike described, these kids are often sleeping in one room with lots of other kids each night, and they don't sleep well. They're hungry. They come to school. It's hard to pay attention. It's hard to learn. It's very difficult when you go back to a shelter to do your homework. And then these kids don't do well in school. They get left back. And they're seen as failures when, in fact, this is due to very difficult external circumstances. So one of the things that all of us need to do is provide more supports in the schools so that these children are able to succeed.
And Mike, a final thought from you, if you would. One of the things you were telling us earlier is that one of the traumas that homeless kids suffer is losing confidence in their parents' ability to provide for them. And I can understand, as a service provider yourself, you don't want to reinforce that. So in just the minute we have left, I'd like to ask you, it is the holiday season. Many people would probably like to help right now. What can you think can people do to be helpful without reinforcing this notion, you know, that the parents are not capable?
For our case, the donation of funds and money to keep people off the streets when it's below zero or freezing is the first basic need so they don't freeze to death. So we have the ability for people to give in that way. They can give of their time and assist. I think the doctor laid it out pretty well. These kids struggle academically, and so if you volunteered and read with the child or did math tutoring with a child, that would be of great benefit. So you don't have to always give money. You can give food, shelter, clothing if you have that ability, if you give through your church. But just don't lose sight of these kids. And like you said, it's a tragedy when you discover that 40% are 6 years and younger. We should all be ashamed if we don't help.
Mike Pomey is the executive director of the Children's Cabinet, which offers services to homeless and other at-risk children in Nevada. He was with us from KUNR in Reno. Dr. Ellen Basak is the president of the National Center on Family Homelessness. She joined us from member station WGBH in Boston. I have the feeling we'll be speaking again about this important story. I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And it may be surprising to many outside Los Angeles to hear that it has an art scene that goes back to the middle of the last century. Maybe because the 50s and 60s in Southern California was a vast landscape dotted with car culture, beach culture, and a growing aerospace industry. Not necessarily art, one thinks. It was also, though, the home of an art scene which attracted artists who were rejected in New York. That's something Hunter Droho Yoskov Philp writes about in her book, Rebels in Paradise.
I really was struck by the boldness of their decision to stay in Los Angeles when they could have gone to New York, and the way they all felt they couldn't grow and do what they needed to do for themselves as artists in New York. They needed the freedom and the permission of Los Angeles, where there were few galleries and collectors and no museum. There was no infrastructure, so they could do what they wanted.
One person who seized the opportunity to do what he wanted was Andy Warhol. The artist who came to epitomize the New York art world actually got his start here in L.A.
The very first Andy Warhol exhibition was in 1962 when he showed the Campbell soup can paintings at Ferris Gallery, which is really sort of the first contemporary art gallery in Los Angeles on North La Cienega Boulevard. Everybody came. The reviews in L.A. were not positive, but nonetheless, the dealer, Irving Blum, managed to sell a couple. Then he had to borrow them back because he realized that actually those soup cans should be shown as an entity unto themselves, that they really were one piece, all of them together. And then, of course, many years later, he was able to sell them to the Museum of Modern Art for $15 million.
Given the sprawl in Los Angeles, it's hard to create a real physical community here, certainly for not like artists have always done in New York City. But there was one place, that was Venice on the beach, that early on had quite a vibrant and tight community.
Well, Venice in the early 1960s was really inexpensive real estate. And that attracted Billy L. Bengston, Robert Irwin, Doug Wheeler, James Turrell, really some fantastic artists, a lot of whom did work with light. And they were certainly affected by the kind of constant changing, beautiful light around the ocean, the same light that actually brought the film studios to the West Coast in the first place.
Light was everything to one of the best-known artists who was drawn to Los Angeles in the 1960s, and that's David Hockney. He, of course, came from a very different landscape and a very different light in England.
Yes, he did. And David Hockney's work was transformed by being in Los Angeles. And he says that it was as though he could see a way of making art here that he could never have seen while he was in London. He was able to switch from using oil to acrylic paint. He started taking photographs of his models or photographs of these scenes. So his work also is very intentional, very controlled, very stylized. And yes, of course, it's the brilliant blue of the sky, the blue of the swimming pools, the green of the palm trees. I mean, ironically, he does become the best known of the Los Angeles artists.
To describe a Hockney painting would be to describe a scene that you can see every day in the more affluent parts of Los Angeles.
Correct. Probably one of his best-known paintings is A Bigger Splash, and it features a swimming pool and just the spray of coming up out of the water of the white foam and a little stucco house in the background. And the impact of a swimming pool on a young boy from northern England in 1966 cannot be overestimated.
When you look back at the time that you are writing about in this book, Rebels in Paradise, what did this one moment in time for the art world of Los Angeles, what did it mean?
Well, the reason I wrote the book is that Ed Ruscha, John Baldessari, David Hockney, these are pretty well-known names in the art world. I mean, John Baldessari is sort of a founder of conceptual art. Ed Ruscha is known as a pop artist, but really it's about words on big words on canvas, or David Hockney, who's known so much for his imagery of Los Angeles. These artists have work that sells for millions of dollars today. They have international reputations. But my book really chronicles what it was like when they were young, struggling artists in Los Angeles, hanging out and trying to make it happen.
Hunter Droho Yoska Philp is the author of Rebels in Paradise. Some of the works in her book are featured in a massive series of exhibitions throughout Southern California on right now called Pacific Standard Time. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.